Now at last, in the winter of 49, they had succeeded in backing him into a corner. For Caesar, the moment of truth had finally arrived. Either he could submit to the law, surrender his command and face the ruin of his career, or he could cross the Rubicon. The die is cast. Only as a gambler, in a gambler's fit of passion, was Caesar finally able to bring himself to order his legionaries to advance. The stakes had proved too high for rational calculation, too imponderable as well. Sweeping into Italy, Caesar knew that he was risking world war, for he had confessed as much to his companions and shuddered at the prospect. Clear-sighted as he was, however, not even Caesar could anticipate the full consequences of his decision. In addition to crisis point, discremen had a further meaning, dividing line. This was, in every sense, what the Rubicon would prove to be. By crossing it, Caesar did indeed engulf the world in war, but he also helped to bring about the ruin of Rome's ancient freedoms and the establishment, upon their wreckage, of a monarchy. Events of primal significance for the history of the West. Long after the Roman Empire itself had collapsed, the opposites delineated by the Rubicon, liberty and despotism, anarchy and order, republic and autocracy, would continue to haunt the imaginings of Rome's successors. Narrow and obscure the stream may have been, so insignificant that its very location was ultimately forgotten, yet its name is remembered still. No wonder. So fateful was Caesar's crossing of the Rubicon that it has come to stand for every fateful step taken since. With it, an era of history passed away. Once there had been free cities dotted throughout the Mediterranean. In the Greek world and in Italy too, these cities had been inhabited by men who identified themselves not as the subjects of a pharaoh or a king of kings, but as citizens, who proudly boasted of the values that distinguished them from slaves: free speech, private property, rights before the law. Gradually, however, with the rise of new empires, first those of Alexander the Great and his successors, and then of Rome, the independence of such citizens everywhere had been stifled. By the first century BC, there was only one free city left, and that was Rome herself. And then Caesar crossed the Rubicon, the Republic imploded, and none was left at all. As a result, 1,000 years of civic self-government were brought to an end, and not for another 1,000 and more would it become a living reality again. Since the Renaissance, there have been many attempts to ford back across the Rubicon, to return to its far bank, to leave autocracy behind. The English, American, and French revolutions were all consciously inspired by the example of the Roman Republic. As to rebellion in particular against monarchy, Thomas Hobbes complained, one of the most frequent causes of it is the reading of the books of policy and histories of the ancient Greeks and Romans. Not, of course, that the desirability of a free republic was the only lesson to be drawn from the dramas of Roman history. It was no less a figure than Napoleon, after all, who went from consul to emperor, and throughout the 19th century the word most commonly applied to Bonapartist regimes was Caesarist. By the 1920s and 1930s, when the republics everywhere appeared to be collapsing, those crowing over their ruin were quick to point out the parallels with the death throes of their ancient predecessor. In 1922, Mussolini deliberately propagated the myth of a heroic, Caesar-like march on Rome. Nor was he the only man to believe that a new Rubicon had been crossed. The brown shirt would probably not have existed without the black shirt, Hitler later acknowledged. The march on Rome was one of the turning points of history. With fascism, a long tradition in Western politics reached a hideous climax, and then expired. Mussolini was the last world leader to be inspired by the example of ancient Rome. The fascists, of course,